the best one, the most competitive, high performance niche vehicle industry in the world, and we need to be expanding on it and making use of it and taking it into other areas of engineering and regaining that design excellence that F1 still has, but we've lost in other industries.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Advanced Engineering Talks, a podcast created by the Advanced Engineering team. A-Talks brings together some of the newest and most innovative minds in engineering and manufacturing to help better the future for our industry. We hope you enjoy the series.
Hello and welcome. I'm once again delighted to bring you to another of our Advanced Engineering Talks podcasts, where innovation never sleeps. My name's Jeremy Whittingham. I'm very excited to be joined today by a legend of Formula One design and engineering who has spent over 25 years at F1 senior technical management level, from McLaren through to Tyrrell, Toyota, Lotus, Caterham and more. He is, of course, Mike Gascoigne. Mike, hello and welcome. Thanks for coming to join us.
Hi there, Jeremy. Hi, guys. I hope you're all well and it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for taking the time out. And just before we go on to asking your first question, I want to also introduce my co-host, Alan Banks. Alan is UK Lightweight Innovations Manager at Ford Motor Company and Chair of the Board of Directors for Composites UK. Someone who's a real expert, not just on composite materials, but lightweighting in general. Alan, delighted to have you co-hosting with me again. Thanks so much.
Pleasure. Great to be here and nice to meet you, Mike.
Nice to meet you guys.
Yeah, great. Now, Mike, back to you. You are, of course, now CEO of your own consultancy, MGI Engineering, and most recently been creating an eVTOL cargo drone demonstrator that we will be showcasing, in fact, at the Advanced Engineering event this November. And thanks for that. You're brilliantly demonstrating, really, how successfully you can bring in technology and innovation from Formula One into another sector here. But could I ask you to just, you know, go back and bring us up to date from how it all started, who or what inspired you into motorsport and engineering in the first place, and some of the milestones in your career, really?
Well, I always wanted to be an engineer and had an interest in engineering from a very early age, always with a love of actual aircraft and aerodynamics. So that was always my intent. I did engineering design as an O level and A level at school because it was available at the school I went to, Wyndham College. Right. And it was always a clear route to me to study aerodynamics at university. I went to Cambridge, did my first degree and studied for a PhD in aerodynamics and fluid mechanics. So that was always really a love of mine. I'd never had a particular desire or follow motorsport in particular. It was only actually when writing up my PhD, which I never finished, I have to ruefully admit to. And the reason I didn't finish it was while I was writing up, I saw an advertisement for an aerodynamicist at McLaren. And this was in 1989, start of 1989, when McLaren were they just finished the 98 season and were absolutely dominant, the 88 season, and were absolutely dominant in Formula One. And I looked at it and, I loved competitive sport. And I loved engineering and aerodynamics. So I saw the job advertisement and thought, well, that's perfect for me. And then I looked at the magazine, the front of the magazine. It was 3 months out of date. So I assumed, the position had been filled. And,
yeah.
But anyway, I wrote off, got a letter back not the next day, but very quickly, and assumed it was a thanks but no thanks. But they asked me to come in for an interview the next day, which I did, and I got the job. So I was the last person to apply and the last person to be interviewed by a long way, and I got the job. And And, you know, a week or a couple of weeks later, I was starting at McLaren, you know, the world championship F1 team as effectively head of aerodynamics. So I was very lucky. And actually, when people ask me how do I get into Formula One, I sort of say, well, be in the right place at the right time, because that's what I did. You know, the rest was history, as they say. And that's why I never finished my PhD.
That's really interesting. That's a really good story, that is, Mike. So you, presumably you worked under Gordon Murray at that point.
Well, Gordon Murray was there. I worked under the two chief designers, Steve Nichols and Neil Oatley. Gordon was actually setting up the road car project and other projects at that stage. So he worked in another building. He wasn't full time on F1 at that stage.
Okay, that's really interesting. So you worked on their first normally aspirated car from 89 onwards then?
Yeah, the 89 car had been finished. I joined after the first race of 89 and then did the aerodynamics for the 1990 season where we won the world championship. Obviously in 89, Prost and Senna driving, and then Prost left for Ferrari. So 90, a very sort of keenly fought battle between Ayrton and Prost for the world championship with Ferrari, which we won. So it was very interesting times.
Well, and from there you went on to Tyrrell, if my memory serves me correctly. Is that right?
Yeah, I went to Tyrrell. Actually, at the end of the 1990 season, I got my first real hard lesson in Formula One, because I, having beaten Ferrari to the World Championship, they hired the head of aerodynamics from Ferrari and booted me out. So, which I found was a little harsh, seeing as we'd just beaten them. But started at Tyrrell. I had an interview with Harvey Postlethwaite, one of the sort of legendary engineers in that era of Formula One. And Harvey went on to be a sort of great mentor for me. So I went to Tyrrell actually as a chassis dynamicist. And but after a few months, Harvey was looking signed a deal to Sauber to set up what was intended to be a Mercedes Formula One team entry, or a Mercedes entry into F1 with Sauber. And he took me with him to set up the aerodynamics department for Sauber. And unfortunately, politics or whatever, Mercedes didn't back the F1 project. And Harvey actually left to go to Ferrari for 2 years. And I stayed on at Sauber and set up the aerodynamics department, did the aerodynamics for their first car, which was the C12, which was actually had a very successful entry into Formula One. And then at the end of 93, Harvey had a pretty difficult 2 years at Ferrari. So he and I met up actually in Sintra in Portugal at an Estoril test. And he asked me to go back. He was going to go back to Tyrrell and sort of run the team, sort of under Ken as team principal. And he asked me to go back as his deputy technical director. So I went back to Tyrrell for sort of 93 until it got sold in 98, and they were probably the most sort of formative and happy years of my Formula One career. Tyrrell was a fantastic place, very innovative team, very engineering led under Harvey. Unfortunately, not commercially successful, but a great group of people, and I really learned my trade there.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, in the late 80s, early 90s, Tyrrell were probably the most innovative team from an aerodynamics point of view. You must have had a field day there.
Yeah, I mean, I joined, Jean-Claude Migeot had worked with Harvey at Tyrrell. They'd done the 019, the high nose car. And Jean-Claude was actually working under the Fondmetal group as doing the aerodynamics for us with Tyrrell, but I ran the aerodynamic program at Tyrrell with Jean-Claude assist. You know, having left McLaren, Tyrrell were actually years ahead of practically anyone else in Formula One, in aerodynamics and innovation and understanding of aerodynamics. And we came up with a lot of very sort of radical things. Tyrrell were sort of years ahead of other teams in terms of innovation and understanding of aerodynamics, and very much shaped my thinking and understanding of the correct way to do aerodynamic testing. And that really became the backbone of my career. I think the two lessons were from Tyrrell were of aerodynamic development in F1, and also prioritizing, because Tyrrell didn't have a lot of resource, but it was very good at prioritizing and making sure you were spending everything on the things that gave you bang for buck. And when I moved on in my career to Jordan, Renault, Toyota, what you realized is that these guys had more money and more people, but were very bad at prioritizing, were very backward in how they were doing their aerodynamics testing, which was the key performance element in F1. And I was able to bring those skills to those teams, and that's what caused their sort of their improvement in performance after I joined. So I got this sort of reputation of turning teams around, and really it was based around all the lessons I'd learned at Tyrrell. And unfortunately, you come to a stage where you've taught everyone how to do it, so there's no one left to go and improve. But it was a very, very good period of my career, all based on the expertise that was at Tyrrell at the time.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, Mike, this sounds like a good time to perhaps bring a bit more up to date. And obviously, you're now doing a lot of work with your eVTOL demonstrator at your cargo drone demonstrator with your own consultancy now, MGI Engineering. And can you tell us a bit about that? And again, you're going to demonstrate that at the show this November. But also interesting to know, you know, what are the key kind of technologies and innovations that you feel you've brought from Formula One that have really been helpful in these drone demonstrators?
Well, I'm sure Alan will have a lot to yeah. comment and say about this, because I mean the key element of MGI is in lightweight structures, so lightweight structures in high performance niche vehicles. And that's what F1 is, and F1 as an industry. Invest because it's such a competitive industry. You know, if you're on pole by, you know, race, Lewis was on pole by 200ths from Max Verstappen. So you're talking about such fine competitive margins. You've got to push everything to the limit. And F1 spent a lot of money doing things and developing techniques for lightweighting. And improving performance of the vehicles that wouldn't be commercially viable. You know, you'd never get your money back from doing it commercially, but F1 does it because of its budgets. And for that reason, you know, F1 has really pushed ahead of where the aerospace industry is in a lot of areas, and which obviously has the concerns about certification and long life and everything. So it's different concerns, but really where MGI engineering comes from is bringing from F1 techniques of lightweight structures and challenging what's conventional in industries like the aerospace industry, and ensuring, you know, you're not just making black aluminium, you're using composites and composite monocoque structures for what they can really do. And, you know, the composites are expensive, but the best way to make them cheap is to use less of it by designing better structures. And I think that's something that Formula One has really embraced, and mainstream industry are a long way behind. So the whole ethos of MGI is to bring that to mainstream engineering, because we've done it. You know, all my guys have got 20 years experience in F1. They've been there and learned all of those techniques. And the ultimate body of that is eVTOL, because electric aviation, and especially electric vertical takeoff aviation, is you know, where you've got to lift a ton of batteries off the ground, is just the hardest game in the book. So you know, it's an incredibly popular, and a lot of investment going into the passenger eVTOL market. You know, I think that is going to take a lot longer to bear fruit than you know, is being claimed at the moment. I think that, you know, it's going to be a long time before you see regular, affordable passenger service eVTOL. But cargo eVTOL and flying into, you know, low emission zones, and, you know, transporting medical supplies, etc., I think there is an application. There's markets that exist already, you know, flying mail and medical supplies to the UK islands and bringing back fresh produce and mail. You know, those applications exist now and don't require huge infrastructure change to make them work. And also you're flying over, you know, over water or whatever. So safety concerns about that. So to me, cargo eVTOL is a huge challenge, which is why we've chosen it as a technology demonstrator for the company. But also it is possible, it is viable, and you know, and passenger eVTOL should be built on hundreds of thousands of hours of safe cargo eVTOL flying. That's the route into safe passenger eVTOL for me, and the industry is trying to do it the other way, and that doesn't seem sensible to me.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with you. I mean, I wasn't there, but the CEO of Composites UK, David Bailey, was at the Farnborough Air Show last year and said that there was more work being done on urban air mobility than there was on probably anything else. I just wondered, how much support do you get from the Centre for Connected and Autonomous Vehicles? I know that's primarily factored around automotive, but surely there's a tremendous amount of crossover with regard to eVTOL aircraft as well. They need to be connected. They need to be, well, I'm assuming that yours is autonomous. It would seem that there's a tremendous amount of crossover that the automotive side and the urban air mobility side could learn together.
Absolutely. And I mean, we, having got involved with the eVTOL world, there's and especially people coming from the aerospace side of things, where, you know, this is an aircraft and therefore it's different. To me, it's just a niche high performance vehicle that happens to fly. So whether that's, you know, the same problems that you have in VTOL with lifting batteries off the ground are exactly the same issues in the automotive field. And, you know, electrifying vehicles is not just a case of sticking a battery or a set of batteries into a current truck or bus, because they're all built out of steel girders. And you need to lightweight that vehicle to make battery power efficient as well, because, you know, to get the ranges necessary and everything, that lightweighting and the use of composite structures in chassis is just as important in any electrical vehicle, whether it's automotive, marine, or aircraft. Of course, with the third dimension in aerospace, it's even more relevant. But I think it's just as so. The crossover to me is absolutely there. I mean, we've done this program and flown our over as an entirely internal project for MGI, but we certainly now, in announcing it and going out there, are looking to work with partners to bring this technology to fruition. And I think another thing I'd say about MGI is we've not launched a vehicle. You know, people sort of say, here's our eVTOL. We've launched a demonstrator. For us, this is just a demonstration of technology. We're now looking to work with partners and their requirements to design real vehicles. So, because for us, coming from motorsport, designing a new vehicle in 6 months is absolutely normal. You know, we're not got that aerospace mindset where we design one aircraft and that's it for 20 years. You know, so this is very much a technology demonstrator, which is why we've labelled it as that.
Yeah. We were having a chat this morning about the crossover between automotive and aerospace, and the way that they're funded sort of collaboratively through Innovate UK. They seem to be in chimneys. You've got ATI and you've got APC, and there's not a lot of crossover there. But the fact that, as you said, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of crossover with connected autonomous vehicles. So I think there's definitely scope that we can leverage through Innovate UK, through the various funding methods, to try and bridge those two industries. It's definitely worth it.
Absolutely. And when you look at eVTOL, you know, you're now looking at making 5,000, 10,000 of, whether it's an air taxi for passengers or a cargo eVTOL. You know, if you're talking about 5,000 specialist composite, high-tech, lightweight niche vehicles, well, that's far more a McLaren or a Ferrari or a Lotus type scenario than it is an aerospace scenario. So how you're producing those vehicles and in those numbers at that cost point, you know, I mean, that's far more automotive. So I think the crossover between those worlds and how you then, especially in production, you know, you're going to need automotive type production lines producing these vehicles in these numbers, because that's the job. So I think that crossover grows and grows and grows.
Yeah, I agree with you. We're kind of at that tipping point where we need each other, as you said, because one of the issues that I face in my day job is when we talk lightweighting from a volume OEM perspective, when we start to look at changing materials, we do just that. We move steel to aluminium, or we move aluminium to glass fiber, or glass fiber to carbon fiber. And people assume that, you know, you just change the material, but you don't. You actually change the entire manufacturing method. You can make one part where you currently, you know, where you might have, you know, sort of 20 parts that are fabricated today, you can make out one part, you know, tomorrow if you change the material. And designing the vehicle is not just a case of changing the material properties in CAE. You physically have to start it all again. And there's a tremendous knowledge gap there, especially from a volume OEM perspective, not just for, but, you know, for everyone, I would imagine. And where do you see things like education within the UK to try and bridge that gap? Because, you know, as you said, there's a lot of experience in aerospace on how to do that. There's a huge amount of experience in motorsport, people like McLaren, people like Lotus, potentially even JLR and Aston Martin as well. But if we want to get kind of volume out of that, then we really need the volume suppliers as well. So we need to kind of re-educate our workforce on how to do that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of really interesting points in there. And I just pick up on the first one about it's not just about changing the material in the CAD system. We were once asked to do a project, which was actually a a crossbeam for a Peugeot car. And, you know, it was a pressed steel beam. And they said, we want to make it out of composite. We want to save this weight. But it was exactly as you said. They said, but then the air conditioning unit fits here, and the bracket for the steering wheel fits here, and the radio has to fit there. And then the passengers, luggage has to go there. And by the time you'd done all of that and you couldn't change them, the conclusion was you'd best to make it out of a pressed steel beam, because that's the cheapest and lightest thing you can do. If you make it out of carbon, it'll be a little bit lighter, but not much, and it will just cost 10 times more. But as you say, if you redesign the air conditioning unit and the things that hold the stick and design them all into one beam and make them all out of composite, it'll be a lot lighter and a lot and not much more expensive, because you've designed a carbon component. You've not replaced a metallic with a carbon component. And that's absolutely key. And then picking up on the education thing, actually, MGI, we work with my old college at Cambridge. I sponsor some extracurricular courses specifically to train engineers to actually be useful, practical engineers when they come out of university. And that's to make sure they have proper CAD experience so they can physically design things and understand the design process. Because it's not about having a 2-1 in engineering or whatever. It's, those skills, yes, they're great. They show you a level of academic capability, but that doesn't mean you've been trained how to be an engineer and a composite engineer and how to use material and how to design real things. And that's something I'm very passionate about. And as I say, I'm working with my college at Cambridge to sponsor that, to train engineers and provide work placement and internships to actually train, and I'm trying to work with the university to say you need to change your course to teach people how to be real engineers, and that's something I'm very passionate about.
That's really good to hear.
Do you feel that over the the last few years you've been doing that, Mike, that have the universities got a bit more theoretical, more so, are the people that you're seeing less able than they were like 10, 20 years ago in terms of application, you know?
I think they're still very theoretical, but, it's not enough to come out from a university with a 2-1 and you've done your week solid works course, so you say, I can draw on CAD, I can be an engineer, because you can't. And what really concerns me at the moment is the atrophying of design skills in the UK. In F1, and actually it's happening in F1 as well, where in F1 20 years ago you went into F1 as a young engineer and you'd be drawing a bit of bodywork, then you'd be drawing a bit of suspension, then you'd be and you would be moving around. And in 5 years, you'd had this fantastic array of different projects and things you'd worked on. And also you would have engineers above you who are mentoring you and teaching you how to design these things and teaching your skills, so that you would go on and you would be a broad based design engineer. And when I see particularly the aerospace industry, the level of design skill has atrophied so much. People don't know how to spec O-ring grooves and basic things that I would sort of basic design skills. People don't know how to do them. And they come through MGI because we've got people that do, because people get pigeonholed now in really small, and they spend 10 years just doing one bracket or one component. And actually the same, and in F1, it used to be much, much better. And it's happening now in F1 as well. We've had people leave us as you know, young engineers because they wanted to get into Formula One. And you speak to them 2 years later, and all they've done is work on winglets on front wing flaps or something. That's all they've done for 5 years. And they don't have this broad range of skills. And in fact, you know, we've got graduates who have grown up with us, who stayed with us, who are way in advance of people who've left to go to other universities, other industries, and even in F1, because they just work on a far broader range of things and still have people to mentor them and teach them how to do proper engineering drawings and properly dimension and properly tolerance things. And those skills are absolutely disappearing from our workforce. And if you lose the experienced guys and you don't have proper mentoring in industry, we'll lose those skills for good.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. So what are your thoughts on, and I guess there's room for both in here, but the apprenticeship route, which is the one I used when I left school, would seem to be the obvious answer to that. And I know that the government have the apprenticeship levy out there, which I think is massively underutilized. Potentially that's the answer, to be honest, because when I was an apprentice, I went around all of the departments and learned what a car was and how it worked. So by the time I'd kind of finished my apprenticeship and I'd done my degree as part of my working life, then I was actually useful to the department I ended up in.
Yeah, and I did a year before going to university up at British Aerospace in Wharton, and again went round all the different divisions and you know, learned the practicalities of life. And I think, you know, with the UTCs that are being set up, I think there is a really big place for a more practical based education thing, because as I said to me, when I apply for graduate engineers and I read the CVs, everyone's got 3 or 4 A-levels, everyone's got 10 GCSEs, everyone's got a 2-1 and did their week solid works course. That doesn't differentiate you. You know, actually what I look for is, you know, far more practical based. Have they done, you know, the Duke of Edinburgh scheme? Have they captain the sports team? Have they got a grade 8 at music or whatever? Have they done something else that shows practical application of skills and getting on? Have they traveled? They're the things that differentiate to me. I mean, one of the things I always look for now is Formula Student, which is a great competition at university.
Yeah.
Did they run their Formula Student team? Did they, you know, did they use CAD in that, you know, they're the differences. A 2-1 or a 2-2 or irrelevant to me. I want to know whether you can be a practical hands-on engineer. And, you know, the standard CV doesn't do that. So I think, as I say, UTC's apprenticeships, where it shows that people have worked in the workplace, they've done real work, they've done, as I say, they ended up, worked on Formula Student for 3 years and ended up running the team. They're the things I look for to employ an engineer, a graduate engineer.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I think that you make a very good point. Mike, I know we've got limited time with you. I want to drag you back, if you don't mind, to your F1 days. And I apologize if I'm going to put you on the spot with this question. When you were in F1, I think there were 12 teams on the grid, if you included Marussia and Lotus. Of those 12 teams, 9 were based in England. And you had, as you know, you've worked with Sauber, you've worked with Toyota. In your opinion, and because, you know, the Advanced Engineering Show likes to push the best of UK engineering technology, with your experience within F1, do you feel that those two teams were hamstrung in any way by not having a UK base?
I don't think they were so much hamstrung, but they made their life more difficult. undoubtedly. I mean, we're, you know, MGI are based, we're just west of Oxford, just sort of south of Whitney. And if you look at it, we've got Williams to the south of us. We've got Alpine just to the north. Up towards Silverstone, you've got Mercedes and Aston Martin and then Red Bull at Milton. So we're surrounded by six teams. So there's that pool of not just staff and people, but support industries to pick from.
Yeah.
And I think and if you want to set up a new Formula One team, that's where you want to be doing it, because you've got this pool of thing, and that's specifically why MGI is based where it is. But, you know, you talk about showcasing UK talent and engineering. I'm very passionate about that. And, you know, unfortunately, one of the sort of mantra is, unfortunately, the UK, when you look at eVTOL, the UK doesn't particularly have an aerospace industry anymore, I'm sorry to say. You know, because it's just diluted and atrophied. But when you look at eVTOL, the UK does have the world's best niche vehicle, lightweight, high-performance vehicle industry, because it does 80% of Formula One. And when you look at eVTOL, to me, it's a niche, as I said before, it's a niche, high-performance, lightweight, vehicle that happens to be an aircraft, and we need to be utilizing, and that's something I absolutely bang on about to the ATI and all of that. We need to be utilizing that niche specialist knowledge we have, because the aerospace industry has lost it, but we have the best one, the most competitive high performance niche vehicle industry in the world. And we need to be expanding on it and making use of it and taking it into other areas of engineering and regaining that design excellence that F1 still has, but we've lost in other industries. We still have it in high-end automotive to some extent, and we need to capitalize that on in new areas such as eVTOL, etc. and you know, EVs in general. That's what we need to be capitalizing on and showcasing.
Do you think companies like Vertical Aerospace, which I'm aware that you have had a tenure with as a CTO as well, are sort of trailblazing a bit in that? I know you mentioned about the passenger versus the cargo situation.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Vertical, you know, Stephen Fitzpatrick, who's someone I know very well, is you know, trailblazing in a very difficult industry, you know, and doing it very bravely. And it was good to see them making their first untethered flights.
Yes,
I think it's a hugely challenging environment. You know, there's a lot of people in the space and some won't make it. You know, I think Stephen has a clear vision of what he's trying to do. And, you know, I desperately hope both for him and Vertical and for the UK aerospace industry that he's successful. I'm sure they will be. You know, we're not going to compete on, on many levels in the aerospace field, but in this niche vehicle market, using, you know, the skills we've got from F1 and that's where, to me, the future lies for the UK to develop as a specialist supplier. And I just hope we take that opportunity, and Vertical are trying to do that. And all power to that.
Okay, no, that sounds really interesting. Yeah, well, Mike, we're sort of more or less coming to an end in terms of our usual sort of podcast length. So, and I know that you know, you've got lots on, so we don't want to keep you too much more. Is there anything else that you wanted to say as a last thought at all before we finish?
No, I think, I mean, I've probably repeated myself time and time again, but I'm, as probably hopefully comes over, I'm very passionate about engineering in the UK.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I was very fortunate enough to luck into working in Formula One, which was a doing job. And I actually look at like eVTOL and some of the other specialist projects we're involved in at MGI. eVTOL, especially, as you know, the first thing that's almost a bigger challenge to me than F1 was, because you know it is a real challenge to get these vehicles to work. And if we can do so, we could, you know, the UK engineering industry can once again lead in areas of engineering. And I'm very passionate about that. I'm very passionate about training young engineers to do that. And I hope this podcast, hopefully some people, youngsters, listen to this and want to get into engineering.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, Alan, you would very much echo that.
Absolutely. It's one of the things we're really passionate about, is trying to fill that skills gap to get people interested. And if we can't do it from an advanced engineering perspective with regard to, you know, the work you're doing at MGI, in the UK's expertise in F1 and the expertise we still have in aerospace in general, then, you know, if we can't motivate the young people of today, then who can? So, yeah, it's really, really great to hear your thoughts on it. They echo ours, which is really good to hear.
We'll be at the Advanced Engineering Show later in the year with the F1 car and a couple of eVTOL aircraft. So we really look forward to everyone coming and visiting us, because I say to my workforce, you know, we're lucky. We don't make washing machines. We make fairly fun things. So I hope everyone is inspired to come to the show and visit us and discuss that with them and enjoy it as much as we do.
Fantastic. Yeah, and we look forward to that just as much as well, for you to bring those demonstrators and the F1 car, definitely. Also, it's worth mentioning that you will be doing a presentation in our aero engineering and space engineering dedicated forum. Again, Formula One technology and a new eVTOL cargo drone program, I think, is your topic. It's basically what we've just been talking about. So, Mike, we're really looking forward to that. Thanks so much for giving us your time today on that. And great conversation. Thank you, Mike Gascoigne, renowned Formula One designer and engineer and CEO of MGI Engineering. And let me also thank you again, Alan, for being my co-host. Alan Banks, UK Lightweight Innovations Manager at Ford Motor Company and Chair of the Board of Directors for Composites UK.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I've been looking forward to this podcast ever since Jeremy asked me to do it. So really good to hear your thoughts and meet you, Mike, even virtually. I know you're a big cricket fan. My advice is don't look at the Ashes score. Not yet.
Oh, dear. Oh, yeah, that wounds me to the core. But later on this year, my beloved Norwich City will be playing. So I very regularly have to not look at their score as well. But thanks very much, guys.
Thank you, Mike. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Take care. Bye-bye now.